Session number 28743.
Hugh Richardson, reel 4.
Am I talking too much?
Carry on.
That was one of the air raids of the war on Malta. No question, it was probably the worst. Well, time passed by, and as I say, we were trapped in Malta for 12 weeks because Crete had been conquered by the Nazis, and the next step was Malta. And it was decided that we couldn't remain idle in Malta any longer. The Navy couldn't supply us with an escort for the journey to Gibraltar because the Navy ships had taken such a beating defending the troops on Crete and rescuing what after Crete fell, they had to rescue hundreds of British soldiers off Crete, and more damage was done to the ships. They couldn't provide us with an escort. So it was decided that we would go single ship to Gibraltar, which was practically suicidal. But the only thing that saved us was that the dive bombers had been moved by Hitler from Sicily to Greece, airfields in Greece, to support the battle for Crete. So the bombing of Malta was left to the Italians. And that was one of our safeguards. So it was decided that we should go a single ship to Gibraltar. And then it was decided that we would try to deceive the Italians into thinking that the settler was an Italian freighter by painting the hatch covers in Italian colours, flying the Italian flag, the biggest one we could find, instead of our red ensign, and that would be an attempt to deceive the Italians into thinking that the settler was an Italian freighter. I never had any hope that it would succeed, because they were obviously going to find that there was no Italian freighters in those waters, and it was a poor effort, but it was an effort. And I remember the Navy gunner saying to me, he said, "Hugh," he said, "we're going to be attacked." He said, "This is not going to work." But he said, "I'll tell you one thing. I'm not going to fight my bloody gun under the Italian flag. No way." He said, "If we're attacked, it's coming down before I operate the gun." And I admired him for that. I thought, well, that's typical Navy. He would not have any thought of an Italian flag. No. So I said, "All right, well, that's your decision." He said, "Yes, that's my decision." It was a 4-inch gun. It was useless against planes because it had no elevation. But it was meant for attacking other surface vessels if they ever attacked us. We had 2 machine guns on the bridge, which were also useless unless pirates were trying to take control of us. That was the armament we were carrying. Anyway, no escort, single ship to Gibraltar. Well, we did all the painting job on the ship and flew the flag. And one night at dusk, we set off for Gibraltar. Well, once again, we were about the last one that left of the convoy because the others were faster than we were and they were going to do the maximum speed, obviously, to get to Gibraltar as quickly as possible. The tankers could do 15, 20 knots, so could the others. We were stuck with our 10 or 13 knots. So we set off at dusk one night, and I remember I was on my usual watch of 12 midnight to 6 a.m. And then when I came out, I went on the bridge, and we were passing Pantelleria, a small island in the Mediterranean, and there were some Italian fishermen out from the island. And Captain Henschel was in no mood to alter course to avoid them. So he just mowed them down. And some Italian fishermen had a very unwelcome swim, and a long one. So that was the first night. And of course, darkness was our friend. And when the dawn came, we began to wonder if our disguise would hold up. Well, we didn't have long to wait. A plane came out and had a good look at us, and then it went back, and another plane came out and circled us, having a look. And it went back, and we waited. And it was, as you can imagine, the tension was building considerably on the settler. And eventually, another plane came out, had a look, went back, and this went on, the typical Italian. And it was getting on, I suppose it was lunchtime and beyond. Yeah, it must have been. We wondered if it would stand up, but it didn't. The next plane that came out was a bomber. And I was on the bridge in the morning, on the Aldous Lamp, and Captain Henschel made his battle plan. He sent for the chief engineer, that man behind you, and he said, "Chief, I want you to go down in the engine room and be on watch." He said, I'm on the bridge. He said, "But we've got to stay where we are, and you just got to put up with it, Chief." He said, "But what I want is this." He said, "You stand by the exhaust steam turbine, and I'm going to keep her at 10 knots, and then if we're attacked, I want you to, when I ring the engine room telegraph, I want you to put that exhaust steam turbine in as quickly as you can get it jacked in and give me another 3 knots. And then he said to the helmsman, "When I yell at you, I want that wheel spun and get the ship round to starboard just as quickly as you can manage." So he said, "That's the plan. I hope it's going to work." So I was on the other end of the bridge and listening to this, and I thought, well, it's a very ingenious plan. It might work. So after lunch, I think it was, it must have been there, because darkness came fairly quickly afterward. The bomber came out, and we knew the game was up, that was the end of the disguise. He circled us, and then he came down on a dummy run. They always did, I'll try to assess our speed. And of course, Henschel kept it at 10 knots where he did his dummy run. And then the bomber went round, and he came on the bombing run. And he was, Captain Henschel was a German by birth, but I couldn't admire a man more. He was magnificent. He was standing there as solid as a rock. He had a pair of Navy binoculars. He was watching the bomber as it came, and he waited for the last moment until he judged, and the bomb bay doors opened at the bottom of the plane, and then he went into action. And he rang the engine room telegraph. Chief engineer put the exhaust steam turbine in. She picked up to 13 knots, and at the same time he yelled at the helmsman, and the helmsman spun the wheel fast, and she turned it beautifully like a yacht. And the stick of bombs missed the stern of the ship so close that they put water all over the gun team on the platform. They were drenched. They were so close, stick of bombs. But Captain Henschel had won. He deceived the pilot because of the speed, and he had deceived him because of the hard shift to starboard. And he stood there on the bridge, and I was petrified, as you can imagine. I must have looked like white faced with fear, but he was as steady as a rock. And then an extraordinary thing happened, and I did not put this on the CD because I had doubts about it being accused of being a racist. The Indian crew, they were all Indian, apart from the officers, and some of them panicked after this attack. Or just immediately after, and they tried to launch one of the lifeboats, and we were doing 13 knots. You can imagine what would have happened, but they were so panic stricken that they were determined to get out somehow of this affair. And Henschel walked to the other end of the bridge, turned the machine gun round, and yelled at them, "Come in board, or I fire." And they came in board. What a man! The coolness and the wonderful decision to make in a situation like that, and he was completely in charge of himself and the ship. Well, as you can imagine, I admired him out of all reason, really, because he was magnificent. No wonder he had a master's ticket and a sail. He was really a seaman. Well, that was the first attack. And funnily enough, it was the afternoon, and there was no other attack. We never discovered why. And darkness came, as I called it, blessed darkness fell, and we had a night when we could relax just a little bit. Well, we wondered what was going to happen the next day, and we didn't have very long to wait after dawn the next day. They tried another bombing attack, they sent out a plane with a torpedo slung underneath, and that was really put us in trouble, because there's no deadlier weapon than an aerial torpedo against a ship. Well, but fortunately, it was an Italian pilot. He wasn't a Luftwaffe, and he came out and circled us. And then I'd gone down. I was off watch. I went down into one of the well decks aft, and I had my hands gripped on the top rail, I remember, and I was watching this plane. And he went round us, and he went on the starboard side, and he started his run in. I saw the torpedo drop into the sea, and I could see the wake quite clearly, because the Mediterranean is pellucid clear, and the wake is visible of a torpedo. It's coming straight amidships. And I was standing there watching this wake coming, and as I watched, my hands started to grip the rail tighter with fear, and the wake came towards us, and it seemed an age, and yet it was must have been only a few seconds. But I thought, well, I don't know what I thought, but I was petrified, literally, absolutely. And there are many descriptions of intense fear, like frozen with fear or petrified with fear. I experienced them all. And the wake reached us, dead amidships, and I waited for the explosion. Didn't come. No explosion. The torpedo had passed right underneath us, right underneath the ship. The Italian pilot had misjudged our draft, and he had dropped it too steeply. And we were a light ship, and no cargo whatsoever. And she was riding high out of the water. And the torpedo passed right under the middle of the ship. Well, I couldn't get my hands off the rail. They were stuck with fear. And I managed to get them off. But we were all absolutely beside ourselves, because that man in the picture, Chief Engineer Slack, He told his grandchildren about this torpedo passing under the ship. No wonder. It was a remarkable escape. Once again, I still think that God was looking after that ship. There's no other explanation. I mean, I know I'm blaming the Italian pilot for making a misjudgment of our draft, but it was amazing, wasn't it? Absolutely. And that was the next day. Well, we had one more bomb attack, which Henschel managed to evade, the same as he had done the previous one. He handled that ship, 30,000 tons, like a yacht. And again, darkness came to our aid. And the next morning, we had a wonderful sight. The Rock of Gibraltar. There it was, in front of us. We had run the gauntlet, but successfully, and we had reached Gibraltar. And I can remember shaving myself in Gibraltar, or in the cabin. And I was gaunt-cheeked, you know, like this, and we were all the same. We all looked like that, because it was such intense pressure and tension that we had experienced, that it had a profound effect on you. I remember in Gibraltar, I looked back on the Mediterranean campaign, and I became convinced that we had had divine providence in looking after that ship. And I'm still of that opinion. I'm still of the opinion. The Sirocco wind was the prime example, altering a wind to cover us with cloud. But all these other escapes as well, all had divine help. And we were hoping that we'd reached Gibraltar safely and that we would come back to the UK. But oh no, we got orders to proceed to Cape Town, Colombo in Ceylon, and Calcutta. Now you can imagine how we felt. That meant another 2 months at least on the voyage. Anyway.
Sorry, just before we go on to the next stage, did you observe obvious differences between the Italian and German pilots, or was it just...
Yes, tremendous. I mustn't be too scathing about the Italians, but they were quite different entirely from the Germans. The Italian pilots would come across Malta and drop their load of bombs in the sea and get back out of it because they wouldn't face the barrage over Malta. It was awesome. Can you imagine an island that size, packed with anti-aircraft guns? The barrage that went up was out of this world. It was the biggest in the world anywhere. So they wouldn't face that. So they dropped the bombs in the sea. But not the Germans. No, the Germans were an entirely different proposition. The difference between the two races was marked. And I rather scathingly said in my CD, which I shouldn't know, I said that the Italian high command of their navy was fully aware that their crews of their warships, which were much more modern and much faster than ours, were quite different. They were more fitted to be opera singers or waiters. And then they were no match for the seamen who sailed under the white ensign. The Royal Navy was streets ahead of them in performance and bravery, if you like. The Italians didn't want to fight. They did not want to fight against us at all, in my opinion. Never. When they did not pursue the way the Germans did. The Luftwaffe those dive bombers were something else. They're a different breed of men. They had been brought up by Hitler's youth to be, they were absolute. They pursued the war with a venomous attack that is hard to describe. The machine gunning of a school bus gives you an example. An Italian would have done that. These were really Nazis, not Germans. They were Germans, but they were a different breed. They'd been brought up by the Hitler Youth Movement from the time they were young, and they were absolutely savage in their attack on the war. Any nation or any number of men who can machine gun a school bus or machine lifeboats, they would sink a ship. And then they would wait until the men were in the lifeboat machine gun it. That is not war, that is savagery. That's a man's got to be beyond the normal attributes, hasn't he, to do a thing like that. But Hitler had got them into such a state that they were the master race and they behaved like it. They were really bad enemies because there was nothing they wouldn't pursue, nothing they wouldn't do. And that's my opinion of the Italian nation. The Italian nation, I still think, were better opera singers than waiters. They were not fighting men. The Greeks found it out. The Greek army was holding the Italians until Hitler put the panzers in. Then they had no chance. They just rolled over them. And the same as Crete. They attacked Crete with a savagery that was unbelievable. Gliders and paratroops. Yes. A big, big difference between Italian fighters and Germans.
And while you were on Malta, did you have any experience of any of the German pilots who'd been shot down, or the Italian pilots who'd been shot down?
No, I never met any of them. I'm afraid that when they were shot down, they were killed. There's no question that the Spitfires. I used to watch the Spitfires coming back from a battle, and they'd do the victory roll as they came across the harbour, and we used to cheer, of course. And the Hurricanes were very good too, and the Bombers. And there was one, I can't unfortunately remember his name, but he became world famous. He was a reconnaissance pilot, and he was partly responsible for the victory at Taranto, because he was such a daredevil that the normal plane that was taking photographs before they mounted an attack would go in once, and then that would be, he'd get his pictures and get out of it, because the ACAC fire around the targets that he was photographing was intense. That this man not only went in once and got photographs, he went round again, went in again, and he became world famous, and I can't remember his name. And that's a terrible thing, I shouldn't say that, but I don't remember his name, but he was, he became, he had decorations galore, and he was not a fighter pilot, not the glamorous ones, he was a photographic reconnaissance, and he became really, as I say, world famous for his absolute bravery, and it of course proved very successful at Taranto. We had marvellous photographs of this fleet lying in harbour, which then they mounted the attack.
Did Captain Henschel's German birth cause any issues?
Yes, I think it did. I think some people were biased against him, that's the difference. He was a German, but he wasn't a Nazi. He left with his family when Hitler was coming to power. He'd left Germany and come to England, and he'd retired, and he volunteered from retirement to fight against Hitler. So he was a German, but not a Nazi, and there's a big difference. And I have no animosity towards the German people, not at all, but I do have against the Nazis. I have German friends, but the Nazis were a different proposition. They were a race apart. Hitler, evil man that he was, had done a tremendous job in making them Nazis from youth upwards. Yeah.
And with the Italian, the Indian crew, what were the relations like?
I mustn't, remember too much that incident, but they were not fighting men. They didn't want to be involved. They would do their normal duties on the ship, but you couldn't depend on them to be anything else. They didn't want to get involved. The incident with the lifeboat was bad. Yes. We had one other incident, or call it an incident, it's wrong to call it that, but I'll describe it. When we left, coming back to the UK for the last time of the voyage, we came into the Bay of Biscay in late or early December. Well, the storms in the Bay of Biscay are notorious in November and December. They always happen, and they're always fantastically bad. Well, when we came into the bay, I was on the bridge, and I was on the bridge, and second officer was on watch with me, and he said to me, "Just wait for a little while, Hugh," and he said, you'll see a storm." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Just wait." So with him, we came into the Bay of Biscay, and it was early December, and there was a violent storm. It wasn't a storm, it was a tempest. The waves were 40, 50 feet, and the wind was incredible. And he knew what he was talking about. Obviously, he'd done it before. And this storm came, and it was incredible. She was 16,000 tons, and she was being thrown about like a cork. I mean, it was. I thought, well, the enemy haven't sunk her, but the elements are going to sink her, because I couldn't see how she could withstand this sea. it was so bad that it was really indescribable. And when you were standing on the wing of the bridge, you went down into the wave, and you went down, and you came up again. It felt like coming up in a lift. And she was rolling so badly that I was sure she was going to be sunk. And I remember that there was a sort of pause in the wind force, and the second officer yelled across at me across the bridge. He said, "We'll make a sailor out of you yet, Hugh." And I said, "Oh no, you won't." Like this was an incredible storm. It was so bad that I actually used the biblical description of a storm, which I can't tell you off the cuff. I would have to have the CD going. And I described this storm as this tempest. And God created this storm, of course, and then he hushed the wind and brought the waves down. And these seamen who were on the ship were rolling about like drunken men because of the intensity of the storm. And he stilled the psalm, and he brought them to their desired haven. Those are the words in the Bible. And we were brought through the storm, and it is still, and we were taken, we went into a port which we had never been in before, and it was our desired haven. It was by coincidence, it was the port of Milford Haven on the Bristol Channel. And we came alongside there, and that was not one of our normal ports. And I took that as an indication, as I say, that it was the same thing as these seamen on that other ship coming into their desired haven in the Bible. And that was the end of the voyage.
When you were when you left Malta, how were the supplies? How was the supply situation?
Very bad, very bad. The worst period in Malta was, fortunately, after I had left the island. We left in round about October time. In early 1942, everyone was convinced that Malta would be attacked from the air by paratroopers and gliders, the same as Crete. And they were able to prevent that by bombing the crates that held the gliders in Sicily, and the fact that they had built up the actual army garrison and the aircraft to such an extent that they had a good defence, let's put it that way. But they were still afraid that they would be attacked from the air. And the supply business on Malta was terrible because the convoys were so badly hurt by sinking the ships that the supplies that they desperately wanted never got there. There was only a tiny percentage of each convoy that made it. That's why our convoy was so remarkable. But the other convoys, like 12 ships would set out and two would get there. Well, you can imagine, two ships with cargoes was not much to feed 370,000 people, the population of Malta, very overcrowded island. And they had eaten all the animals, and they were desperately short of food. There's a small island called Gozo, which is off Malta to the north, and they grow the crops there, and of course Malta's largely rock. But they grow the foodstuffs for the islands there. But you see, once again, the Nazis knew all about Gozo, and they knew that the supplies of produce came from there. So what did they do? The Nazi Luftwaffe go across Gozo and machine gun the women in the fields and stop them, literally, you know, attack them for that reason. So that the supplies from Gozo were drying up. And everything was at a pitch that they were so close to starvation, real starvation, that how they survived is beyond praise. I mean, the rationing, so-called, in England was nothing in comparison to what these people had to suffer.